Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu. Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Welcome to Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk about why there's only one covered bridge left in Wisconsin when there used to be 40. That's in our Curious Wisconsin segment, coming up in about 15 minutes.
First, the Target Corporation announced today that data from 40 million credit and debit cards may have been stolen from their stores during the holiday shopping season.
Details of that theft are still being investigated, but the story has raised significant concerns about the safety of our personal information in general, and has a lot of Target shoppers wondering, what do I do now?
Joining us now to sort this out is Rob DeVideo, professor of criminal justice at Drexel University. Rob, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on. How are you today?
Doing okay. Little bit of a jolt this morning, waking up and hearing, like a lot of the world, that a huge number of credit cards have been stolen, it seems, from Target, and people are worried about this. How bad does this breach look right now?
Well, I want to let, you know, consumers know that there's nothing unique about this. The uniqueness about this is the volume of credit cards that's involved. These types of breaches happen on a regular basis. It doesn't make it any more easy to stomach, especially if you're one of those 40 million people like I am who have shopped at Target during the time in question here. The type of attack that looks like is behind this is nothing new.
Kind of a bad time of the year, like you said, and this has got to be news that the Target was not real happy about. And, you know, we were jokingly saying in the office, who hasn't shopped at Target during that period of time? You know, this is the high end of the shopping season. Does that make it a worse story for Target and for consumers?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly an element of concern because of the time of the year. As people are feverishly shopping or finishing up their holiday shopping, you want to know that your credit card is secure, that you have it accessible to use when you're going out to get these last-minute gifts. My recommendation, and I might be jumping ahead here, but with the recommendation that people be proactive in this instance, don't wait for the call from the credit card company or the letter from Target to go and shut your account down and get your bank or your credit card company to issue a new account. That definitely complicates the holiday shopping process. Let's put it that way.
So why are you
might be out of your account, your card for a day or two.
So that's why to avoid a lag in time between when you process this and get your new card, you're saying it's easier to just go out and cancel it today?
Well, the concern is if we look at how identity theft has evolved, no longer are the people who are stealing the identifying information, the credit card numbers, the Social Security numbers, et cetera, no longer are these people the ones who are using it. They're stealing this information. They're going after large troves of data, as we see in this case, right? 40 million plus credit card numbers and associated information. And then they're taking those large data sets and then they're brokering them and selling them online. There's a huge underground marketplace for stolen personal identifying information that runs the gamut, everything from credit card numbers to access credentials to get into various types of financial services accounts online to video game accounts online. All these accounts have the potential to be converted into real-world currency. So these people are selling the information instead of using it themselves and brokering it to the people who will wind up eventually using it. So the consumers do have a period of time to protect themselves, right? The goal is for you and I who have shopped at Target to make sure that nobody actually goes out and purchases something with our credit card, because that's where, you know, the consumer end of identity theft comes into play. Right now, it's primarily a problem for Target, and we can take some simple steps as consumers to make sure it doesn't advance further, because once they have that, especially if they have your debit card information, they're going to take money directly out of your checking account. They're going to rack up bills. And you might not in the end be ultimately responsible, but it's going to take you a lot of time to straighten it out, going down, getting affidavits, getting police reports, getting new account information. It can all be very time-consuming, very stressful. I know personally I've fallen victim to a number of instances where people have used my credit card or debit card information without my authorization, and personally you feel like you've been violated. So we can't discount the psychological stress on top of it, on top of the stress of the season already. It can be pretty pretty difficult to contend with.
Now, you said there's nothing that unusual about this. I mean, yes, it's a large number of cards, and it's happening right at the holiday season, but this happens apparently quite a lot. Does that mean that it's pretty easy to do?
Well, you know, I don't know enough about this case to say how easy it is, but in this case, what it looks like is that there was a intrusion that involved the point-of-service transaction system that's used by Target, right? And that's the system that processes all those credit and debit card transactions. So when you go swipe your credit card at Target, information is put in, is processed through this piece of software to mediate that transaction. And they were able to take the information. It looks like they were able to take that information being processed through this point of sale system and store that information, send it out for send it out to a larger data collection was stored offsite from the initial breach. So they're actually remotely transmitting all this information off the Target network to a remote server, and it's likely out of the United States, right? So we've seen those types of attacks before. That's what I'm saying. Point of service attacks associated with merchants. It's nothing new. We've seen it before. Now, the actual sophistication of the attack, we likely will never find out. Target will probably not release that detailed of information about it.
Now, you said the thing to do is to save yourself the hassle and just go and get a new card right away. Don't wait for it to become a bureaucratic nightmare that's going to take some time to sort out. So that's one pretty solid step. Is there anything else, though, that we should be doing?
Well, you want to monitor your statements correctly. You want to monitor your statements both correctly and very often, right? So when I say correctly, you just don't want to go and look at the bottom balance saying, oh, I spent roughly around $1,000 this month in holiday shopping, and my bill is $1,100, so I guess that's correct. Go through it line by line and make sure there are no suspicious purchases. And do that on a regular basis. If most consumers have access electronically to their bank accounts and credit card accounts, and bank accounts being connected to the debit card, do that on a regular basis, at least for the next few weeks, if you're not going to go and cancel that account. I do recommend, I don't think it's sort of like the nuclear option. I think it's the smart option nowadays. If you're someone who has shopped at Target, go and ask your financial institution, whether it's your bank or a credit card company, to go and cancel that account and issue you a new account. It's much easier to contend with at this point than it is down the road.
Should be preemptive and just, every 3-4 months get a new credit debit card if this is something that's so prevalent right now?
Well, I don't think we need to go to that extent. What we have a situation here is data have been compromised. Now, I was hoping Target would come out, and maybe they have. I haven't been able to digest everything that's out there on this, but it would be helpful to know if the data were encrypted or unencrypted. I'm assuming it's in an unencrypted format at this point, or they at least had access to it in an unencrypted format. If it were encrypted, my assumption would be it would be all over the news that it was encrypted, only because that would add that would add some confidence to any sort of assumption that your data are not going to be used maliciously, because they're not going to be able to access it in what we call plain text format, meaning that, you know, the numbers being out there in the open that you and I could read.
Now, as far as retailers, what do they do to protect themselves? I mean, is this the kind of thing that they're just always going to be falling short on? The scammers are always going to be one step ahead?
Well, you know, it's a never-ending task. I mean, you have to make sure your networks are fully secured. That includes, you know, understanding where the vulnerabilities are. Vulnerabilities come to the forefront on a daily basis because maybe software patches that were installed that maybe weren't tested with existing software on a network, and as a result there's a vulnerability. Maybe there's a, you know, you don't have a dedicated staff to going out there and managing that update process and assessing the security that's associated with that update process. That can be a very, very time-consuming task, and all too often that is thrown to the back, down the list on priorities when it comes to maintaining the operations of a large retail enterprise. You know, I think that in today's day and age, if you're not going to be hypervigilant about protecting your customers' information, and you don't have the right to be in business because of the impact this can potentially have on, in this case, millions upon millions of people, the negative impact. And again, I don't want to make it sound like the sky is falling, but, you know, Target did not hold up to its end of its responsibilities here to its customers. Yes, it seems like they're dealing with it correctly on the backside. But the simple fact is the attack happened, the attack occurred.
Now, how big a badge of shame do you think this is going to be for Target going forward? We already heard in the news break just before this interview that their stock has fallen already. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's certainly, you know, we've done some research at Drexel. I've done some research to look at, you know, what the best way to break the bad news to individuals in this case, right? In the case of a network breach where their personal information has been compromised. And consumers want to make sure that they're told the truth and given a description, an accurate description of what has happened. If you don't tell them that and you don't do that, you don't come out in front of this, they're going to harbor resentment, right? So it's almost like you're seeing a sentiment change, right? You know, people are saying, all right, I understand this is the cost of living in the, you know, information age and, you know, distance, e-shopping, et cetera. We're to expect this, right? We just want to be kept in the loop. We want to be protected, and we want to make sure you're on our side. You know, so, you know, getting notification letters that aren't signed by someone within the, administration or chain of command, high up in the chain of command of a corporation, and if, you know, it's not a personal signature and maybe it just says, you know, sincerely or regards, the security department, right? People take offense to that. So, you know, I think that in the past where corporations and organizations who suffered breaches used to take a step back and say, we want to keep this hush because we don't want our consumers finding out, it's going to negatively affect us. I can tell you this much. The research shows that if they in fact do that and it gets out, which it always has a way about doing it, they're going to harbor much more resentment towards you than if you were to come out, admit it, apologize about it, and offer them services that are going to help them protect their identity. This morning I woke up. I happened to be working from home this morning. My wife was working from home. We woke up. She was going through the mail from yesterday, and I'm reading about the Target breach just as everybody else is. And she's sitting there opening a letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield saying that her information, you know, we use those, they're our medical insurance provider, her information was compromised because two laptop computers from Blue Cross and Blue Shield were stolen with a database of customer information on it that was unencrypted, and it contained Social Security number, name, and various bits of demographic information.
Boy, right? Not a good news morning for...
Not a good news. So these things do happen on a regular basis. But the point, you know, back to this letter, the first sentence was very apologetic. We are sorry. We know we let you down. And that's what consumers want to hear. You know, they don't want to be thrown out into, you know, navigate this, what can be a very complex, tedious, and time-consuming process of cleaning up their credit and making sure their personal information is not being further compromised. They don't want to be left out there alone. In this case, Blue Cross Blue Shield did a good thing in the sense they're giving us free one-year credit monitoring protection. We don't have to go out and pay for that service, which I would normally have to do if they didn't. They didn't do this. This would be something I would normally do.
All right.
Well, especially with the Social Security number involved.
We'll be watching how Target behaves itself here on out. And bottom line, cancel the card. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, great. Happy holidays and best wishes in 2014.
And also to you, happy holidays. We've been talking to Rob Davidio, professor of criminal justice at Drexel University. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In Curious Wisconsin today, we visit a unique Wisconsin landmark, and in a bit we'll invite you to share your questions that we can answer on Curious Wisconsin.
Once upon a time, more than 40 covered bridges dotted the Wisconsin countryside. Today, there's only one. It's the Cedarburg Bridge, originally known as the Red Bridge.
In the town of Cedarburg, it's 20 miles north of Milwaukee near the junction of Highways 60 and 143 on Covered Bridge Road. Jim Collada is the administrator of the town of Cedarburg. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So first, I want to ask why, you know, I'm used to the uncovered bridges. Why were some bridges covered?
Well, you know, that's one thing that's been speculated on over the years, and some of the suggestions for why it was covered when it was built in 1876 was to possibly help when the area farmers would drive their oxen across the bridge. Sometimes they were a little fearful of crossing that when it was open, so they built walls and covered it with a roof to perhaps help the animal get through. Others have speculated it just is helpful for travelers to have an opportunity for shelter if storms do arise.
But it wasn't just to keep snow off. In fact, as I understand it, they sometimes actually put snow onto the bridge. Is that right?
You know, I've heard that. I don't know if I can confirm that that's part of the rationale for that or if it in fact did occur.
But I had heard they put it there to get sleighs across sometimes?
For the town, I know the reason why we built it because the area farmers were in need of getting across that area, perhaps to go to downtown Cedarburg to sell some of their goods.
Okay. And why was the Cedarburg Bridge known as the Red Bridge?
Yeah, that's something I don't know if it's widely known, but I believe it was originally painted red. And if you look at it today, the pictures today, you really can't see it. But if you get up close, just underneath the roof line in some areas, you can see some of that red paint.
Okay, so it's still a little red, but if you just looked at it from a distance, you wouldn't call it a red bridge.
Absolutely not.
Okay. So you mentioned when it was built. Anything you can tell us about how it was built or anything that went into the construction?
Sure. You know, it's primarily made up of pine and some oak logs. We believe that they were milled in Baraboo, and they were brought out onto the site and fit and put into place using a lattice truss construction. So by and large, they're 3x10-inch planks, and there aren't any nails or bolts used. Instead, they secured the wood together using 2-inch hardwood pins.
So no metal in it, no nails.
Right, not when it was originally constructed, that's right. And I believe today it's primarily the same.
And why has that bridge, that covered bridge, stuck around in Wisconsin while the rest of them are, as far as I know, all gone?
Well, it's certainly something that was first of all used and in place for many years. It wasn't retired until 1962. And I know from the town and Ozaukee County standpoint, you know, we cherish it as a unique part of our culture and our history.
And it's not is it used at all today? People don't drive across this now?
No. In fact, it's really just for pedestrian use. There is a concrete bridge right next to it for cars and trucks.
And do people, is this a big tourist attraction? Do a lot of people come to check out our state's last surviving covered bridge?
Yeah, I'd say it's very popular. You know, it's not uncommon to see wedding photography done there. Families also like to go there and, you know, not only play in the park that's right next to the bridge, but also check out the bridge and read a little bit about the history of it on some of the plaques that are nearby.
All right. Thanks to Jim Collada, administrator of the town of Cedarburg. You can see that in the town of Cedarburg, about 20 miles north of Milwaukee. That was one of our Curious Wisconsin conversations. We're always looking for your suggestions at 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422, or you can email centraltime@wpr.org.
And you can leave anything else you've got on your mind, your program suggestions for Curious Wisconsin as well.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Food Friday. This week we'll talk about steamed puddings with one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton.
We'll also share some songs with Vietnam veteran and author Doug Bradley. We'll be playing our favorite tunes from the Vietnam War era.
And we'll get our weekly roundup of state news stories from WPR Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky.
Also the value of resilience, the capacity to bounce back, and why it matters.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrack.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The alternate worlds created in fantasy and science fiction works are places to explore issues that exist in the real world sometimes, things like desires, stereotypes, or oppression.
One of those issues is the role of women in society. Well, these genres sometimes get stereotypes typed as a boy thing, written by men, read by men. That doesn't always hold true, especially not today.
The crazily popular HBO series Game of Thrones is just one example of how fantasy's broad appeal can cut through gender and even generational divides.
Today we're joined by two big names in the science fiction and fantasy genres to discuss the role women play in these alternate worlds. George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozois join us now. George is the best-selling author of A Song of Ice and Fire, on which HBO's Game of Thrones is based. Gardner is a Hugo Award-winning science fiction editor of a lot of books and magazines. Their new anthology is called Dangerous Women. George, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And Gardner, welcome to you.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here, too.
Gardner, let's start with you. This is Dangerous Women, nearly 800 pages of original work. Where did the idea come from to do this anthology dedicated to dangerous women?
Well, as I recall, the idea was originally George's. We discussed two anthology ideas when we first came about with the idea of doing anthologies collaboratively together. One was a book called Warriors that we did. And the second was Dangerous Women, although at the time we were calling it Femmes Fatales, a title that nobody liked.
I liked it. I was the only one who liked it. But I got outvoted by everyone else.
Yeah, George liked it, but everybody else loathed it. So eventually we changed the title to Dangerous Women and did sell it, although it took us several years after we sold Warriors to actually place it with a publisher. I think that's mostly because the publishing industry was going through a recessionary period at that point in 2008, and it was hard to sell anything. It might have had something to do with the outmoded idea that science fiction fans don't want to read about women, which is something I ran into from time to time in the old days.
Well, George, I want to ask you, is this an idea whose time has come? I mean, we've got Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. We've got Paige Mahoney in The Bone Season. We've got Daenerys Targaryen. These are women who are dangerous. And, you know, whether there are still people who think that, you know, it's not exciting to see a girl kick butt. I mean, maybe we are now. Is this a time? Is this the time for this sort of book?
I think this is part of an ongoing process that's been going on at least since the 70s. I mean, there have always been a few women in the fields of science fiction and fantasy. But if you go back to the 30s and the 40s, they had to disguise their gender under various assumed names. You had Lee Brackett, who had a name that people didn't know whether it was a man or a woman, C.L. Moore, who used initials, James Tiptree Jr., who was really Alice Sheldon. There was so much resistance then to women authors and writing about women characters that these wonderful writers of an earlier period had to, you know, essentially put on masks. That really started breaking down in the 70s with the rise of the feminist movement, and you had a whole new wave of women writers. And it's continued to break down. I don't think we're at any we're at parity yet, but certainly there are far more women writers and there are far more books featuring women. And you have men writing about women lead characters as well as women writing about them. So it's an ongoing process, but I think it's changing, and it's changing for the better. And I think you have a debate. I mean, part of what Dangerous Women is about, too, is and one reason it's probably better that we did change the title is that the Femmes Fatales, our original title, represented a kind of older archetype of what constitutes a dangerous woman, you know, the seductress who uses her beauty and sexual charms to get her way or to undermine the man. That's dangerous, certainly, and that's one. But now we have the woman warrior as represented by a number of stories in our book and by such movies as Alien with Sigourney Weaver, you know, playing Ripley, and you know, many other examples that are coming to the fore. So I think there's a lot of change going on.
When you're creating your own world in fantasy or science fiction, it seems like you have an option when it comes to women and gender differences. You can say, this is my world, I say men and women are equal. Or you can say, this is a world, but there are similar things to the real world, and my characters have to deal with the same differences, the same maybe oppression there is in the real world. George, let's start with you. How do you split the difference in making that kind of decision?
Well, I think some of the decision is dictated to you by the nature of the world. You know, as science fiction and fantasy writers, we can make choices in that regard. Now, Robert Jordan, who wrote the very popular fantasy series Wheel of Time, set up a magic system in his world that only women could operate. So women had access to this magical thing that he called the One Power or the One Source or something like that. Women could operate it. When men tried to operate it, it drove them mad. So essentially all the wizards in that world were women. Obviously, you have a situation like that, that's going to change society. If you're writing science fiction and you have a high technological base where, you know, people are getting around in starships and they have, you know, ray guns and blasters and phasers and what have you and robots to do their bidding and all that, there's no logical reason for any one sex to be dominant over the other sex. On the other hand, if you're writing a medieval or a Dark Ages story or something closely based on historical fiction that's pre-technological, where you still have, you know, you have no effective birth control, where people are fighting with swords and horses and physical strength, then history tells us that you don't get egalitarian societies out of that. So you really have to look at what kind of background you've designed, and if you want to have a different message, you know, you have to change the background. I mean, I've written in the course of my career, I think, both kinds. In my old Thousand Worlds science fiction stories, I don't think there was any particular distinction between men and women and the roles that they played in society. But when I'm writing medieval fantasy, I take a different approach to it.
Now, Gardner, you've edited a lot of science fiction and fantasy over the years, and I'm thinking back to when Harry Potter first came out, and I remember seeing an op-ed or two that said, you know, what is this, what is Harry Potter doing being a boy? You've got this female writer, we're ready to have a female heroine. Are women now taking the lead when it comes to writing dangerous heroines, cool women heroines in the worlds of sci-fi and fantasy?
Well, I think they have been for a number of years now. Probably one of the first kick-ass heroines was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And although the producer and creator there was a man, many of the women who wrote the scripts for the show, or many of the writers who worked on that show were women. Also, the field has changed a lot. You know, even during the time that I've been working on in the field since the mid '60s, there are a lot more women writers these days in both science fiction and especially fantasy. And as different kinds of people come into the field, they of necessity bring in different perspectives and different values. And they're not just going to repeat the old viewpoint of society towards women from the 40s or 30s. Also, you have to understand, I think, that the society is layered like a parfait. It's not ever all the same thing with social attitudes all the way to the bottom. Even in our own society, you have some states that have made it legal for gays to marry, and you've had some states that, you know, are firmly entrenched against the idea. And the, you know, how women are valued under the law varies greatly from state to state and country to country. So it's never going to be all the one thing. There's always going to be some people who are Neanderthals and some people who are liberated and advanced, and they all sort of coexist at the same time and bump up against each other and grind against each other sometimes.
Well, we're speaking right now with George R.R. Martin, author of the best-selling series A Song of Ice and Fire, on which the HBO show The Game of Thrones is based, and also joining us, Gardner Dozois, acclaimed science fiction and fantasy editor and novelist, and together they're the editors of a new anthology called Dangerous Women.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have any questions or comments about the role that women play in science fiction or fantasy, or a favorite dangerous woman character in those genres? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with best-selling author George R.R. Martin and acclaimed editor Gardner Dozois talking about their new anthology called Dangerous Women.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have any questions or comments about the role of women and the characters you've read in science fiction and fantasy? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And George, I want to ask you one more question before we dig into our phone calls. You've created some especially compelling characters, women characters, you know, in the sci-fi genre in recent memory. You've got the evil queen Cersei. You've got Daenerys Targaryen, the would-be dragon queen who conquers with these roving armies. You've got a sort of roving knight protector woman named Brienne, who is really unattractive, but she really can get the job done. Are there particular joys that come from writing women characters like this, or is it just the same as creating, you know, a male character who does the same kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, I don't tend to think of, I'm now going to sit down and create a woman character. To me, these are all individuals to me, and I particularly with the viewpoint characters, and all the ones you've named are viewpoint characters. You know, I try to get inside their skin and make them as compelling and interesting and complicated a character as possible. None of them are meant to be, you know, a representation of all of womanhood. They are themselves, and they are a product of their own dreams and desires and upbringings and DNA and so forth. So I think it's, you know, one of the advantages I have is I have so many characters. I mean, Game of Thrones literally has a cast of thousands. So I don't run the risk that some authors do where you only have one woman in a story or you have only one minority character and people say, well, that's, look at how they portray women as just one woman. I can portray women in many, many different ways mm-hmm. because I have many, many different women. And to my mind, that fits, that's true. That fits life. That certainly life as I've observed it. I mean, I've been around for a few decades now and I've met a lot of women in my life. I've met a lot of men in my life and they're all different. You know, you get in trouble when you make generalizations. All women are like this. All men are like this. All men want this. All women want this. Or fill in, all Hispanics want this. All blacks are like this. Those generalizations are always wrong, I think. There are always more exceptions than people who actually fit whatever generalization you're making.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Dania in Cassville. Hi, Dania.
Hey.
What's your question or comment?
I just want to comment on aliens. I just want to mention that even though you know, Ellen Ripley, you know, Sigourney Weaver being Ellen Ripley, she's still, even though she's a warrior woman, she is still acting like a woman. But she's not the, you know, stereotypical woman. She doesn't, you know, cower in fear like her female counterpart in Alien. You know, how she, when she saw the alien, she kind of freaked out and kind of not moved, even though Ellen's like, you got to keep moving and all this. And I also want to mention, not only in literature and movies, but in video games, you see a lot of strong female women. There is a game called The Last of Us. There are two particular women in there. There's a woman named Tess. She's like this, you know.
Danny, I want to cut in because we have limited time and a lot of callers who want to get in. But Gardner, you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. How about Ripley from the Alien series as a leading edge of the dangerous women in science fiction?
I think that to riff off of what George said, Ripley is a tough, resourceful individual. I mean, it could be a man, it could be a woman. It doesn't really matter that much. It's the fact that the character is willing to take chances in defeating the aliens and knows how to do so and is intelligent and resourceful and figures it out. Now, a few decades ago, the automatic default setting for that character would have been that it was a man. Now I think we've reached a point where nobody is going to object to the idea that a woman could be intelligent, resourceful, and brave just as much as a man can.
Ripley is actually an interesting case because, I mean, especially if you look at the first two movies, which were in the original movie, Alien, in the original script, Ripley is a man. The script just says Ripley, and the first draft of the script. That was changed when it was cast, I believe, by director Ridley Scott, who decided it would be interesting to cast Ripley as a woman, but without rewriting the script at all. They just took the character as written, as Gardner says, a tough, resourceful member of the crew of the Nostromo, and they didn't, you know, feminize it or make any changes. They just cast an actress, a very talented actress, in a role and created this character. Now, in the second movie, the James Cameron movie, Aliens, they introduced, first of all, that's the movie where Ripley gets her first name. That's the first time anyone ever calls her anything but Ripley. That's where we learn her name. First name is Ellen. And the whole movie relates around her relationship with the little girl, Newt. So you see this maternal side coming out where, you know, all of the male characters in the movie are trying to survive and to defeat the aliens and get off the planet. But it's only Ripley who forms this relationship with Newt and risks so much to save this little girl. So in some ways they're taking a very different approach there. But I think both movies were very successful and the character was a terrific one.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Danya. And we go next to Sean and Nina. Hi, Sean.
Hi. So I want to say first, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll be honest, I haven't read Song of Ice and Fire, but I've been trying to watch Game of Thrones, and one of my big problems with it is the amount of sexual violence that I saw, especially in the first season, and I haven't really been able to catch on since then. I was wondering if you could sort of discuss that for a second or maybe explain the logic behind it, and I'll take my comments off air.
All right. Thank you, Sean. And George, that's to you.
Well, I can comment more, you know, about the books. I mean, the TV show, people have commented on, you know, the amount of nudity in it. I don't think it's any different than any other HBO show in that regard.
I think HBO tends to have a reputation for that. And, you know, I have read the books, and there is sexual violence in the books.
Or the threat of it is
throughout. The threat of it is throughout, right.
There is. And, you know, I'm writing about a world where I think that stuff took place. I mean, there are a lot of people talk about the level in my books, but sometimes I wonder if they've read real history. I mean, not only sexual violence, but violence of any sort, compared to the stuff that went on in the actual Middle Ages, during the Crusades, during the Hundred Years' War, the massacres, the genocides, the level of torture was commonplace. This was, you know, a large part of the Middle Ages. It's now become the fashion to call it the low Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages, but I still prefer the earlier term of the Dark Ages. They were pretty dark, dark times, and people were not safe. And rape was commonplace. Rape is still a huge problem in particularly in times of war. You know, we see it in our present day, in like the recent wars in the Balkans, where rape was actually used as a weapon. We saw rape in World War II. You know, when in some of the counts have millions of rapes taking place there. There seems to be a real connection here between violence and sexual violence. Right. So I think not to portray it, to leave that out, to have fights and wars and bloodshed where that's not taking place, I don't know. That doesn't strike me as being real.
Back to our callers now with Sabrina and Shano. Sabrina, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to discuss some of my favorite female characters. I really appreciate Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki and the books that he adapts and the characters in such books like Howl's Moving Castle and Spirited Away and things like that. And I think those were really great role models, especially for young girls in society.
Sabrina, thanks so much for the call. We just have a couple minutes left, and I was hoping to get maybe a favorite character from the new anthology from each of you briefly. Gardner, somebody who sticks out in your mind from one of the stories.
Well, there are so many of them, it's really hard to pick one. In a way, one of my favorites is the old lady in Megan Lindholm's story, Neighbors, who is a perfectly realistic senior citizen woman facing the threat of Alzheimer's and all of the other dispowerments that go along with advanced age, and manages to keep her spirits up and her integrity and resourcefulness in spite of all of that.
And George, outside of your own novella, you can't pick your own here.
Well, I won't, yeah. In terms of a kick-ass woman character, Joe Abercrombie's hero in the very first story in the book, Shy, who's also the hero of his novel, Red Country. But Shy is, the kick-ass woman, as we've referred to it here. She's a really tough, dangerous, skilled with weapons. You don't mess with her or you wind up with your head on the ground. Joe writes a great action scene. His story is just nonstop action from beginning to end, and Shy is very engaging. But as Gardner says, the book is filled with them and with different definitions of we do have femme fatales in the book, women who are not necessarily skilled with sword or lance or gun, but who are, you know, use what used to be called feminine wiles or seduction or something to get their way. We have the women warriors. We have characters like the older woman that Gardner refers to in Megan Lindholm's wonderful story. So you can see many different takes on dangerous women in the anthology, and we hope this will get the readers to think about all this stuff.
George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's fun.
Gardner, thanks to you as well.
Well, thank you.
That's George R. R. Martin, author of A Song of Ice and Fire, source of the HBO show Game of Thrones, and Gardner Dozois, acclaimed science fiction and fantasy editor and a writer himself. Their new anthology is Dangerous Women.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.